Indeed, that is what the preterist view of Bible prophecy is all about. We don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. We believe the end-time prophecies were already fulfilled in the first century in connection with the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. Keep in mind that there's a PDF lesson outline available for this podcast, and there's always some extra information and sources listed in it which we don't always cover here in the podcast. And that's especially true this time. There's probably 6 pages of information that we're not going to be able to present because of time limitations. Most listeners have found it very helpful to have that PDF in front of them as they listen, and I would encourage you to request that by email so that you'll have it to listen or to watch and look at while you listen to this podcast. It's not posted on the Covenant Key website, however, so I would be happy to send it to you if you simply email me and request it. And a number of you have mentioned that it's a real pain to have to request that each time. So I'm going to develop a list of folks who I will send it to each week in advance, just before it's aired here on Sunday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. And that way you'll have it in front of you as you listen to the podcast live. So if you'd like to be on the list of those who get those podcast PDFs in advance, just send me an email and let me know, and I'll put you on the list. And that way you'll automatically get it. You won't have to request it each time. Let's ask God for His guidance here in our study together. Our Heavenly Father, the Ancient of Days, because You made us, You know us infinitely better than we know ourselves. You understand our hearts and know that we praise You and thank You and exalt You for what You have done throughout history to redeem us from our eternal separation from Your holy presence. We again humble ourselves and ask for Your guiding hand upon this nation who has forsaken You and Your ways. Show us the error of our ways and lead us to repentance so that we will seek You with clean hands and a pure heart. Be with us especially now as we study the history of Your first century saints. Help us understand Your word better and better every day so that we can apply it to our lives and teach it to others. It is in the name of the God-man Jesus that we pray, who alone is worthy. In Jesus' name we pray, amen. If you benefited from these studies and have been encouraged in your faith and have a better understanding of Scripture as a result of it, we would encourage you to become partners with us in this teaching ministry in order to share in all the good fruit that comes from this work. Those who contribute to International Preterist Association will receive some of our latest and greatest resources as our gift to you. Simply go to our website and click on the left sidebar button entitled Make a Donation to IPA, where you can make a one-time gift or contribute monthly. Our website address is www.preterist.org. Or you can go to PayPal and send a donation that way as well. Our PayPal address is Preterist1, and that's the number 1. It's not spelled out. Preterist1, just the number, at preterist.org. In our study last time, we showed why I believe the canonical book of Hebrews was written as a corrective to the non-canonical epistle of Barnabas. We looked at the historical traditions about Barnabas and Mark to see how these traditions might harmonize with the biblical narrative. We noticed that there was a good fit between those two, between the Bible and the traditions. They work well together. They harmonize. This session we want to look at when the Apostle John most likely wrote his gospel and the book of Revelation, and his 3 short epistles. These 5 books of John are the most challenging of all our New Testament writings to which we're able to assign dates. I mean, it's just really challenging. All the theologians have struggled with how to date those 3 epistles of John especially. They really are, I think, the most challenging of all the New Testament writings to assign a date to. The only reliable evidence we have for John and his writings comes from the Bible, and there is not a lot of that there, and so we have to be very careful how we handle that limited evidence from the Bible. None of the external traditions about John have any first century eyewitness support, except for perhaps Papias, or Papias, if you want to say it probably more correctly. I say Papias, that's the way Texans say it, but it's probably Papias in the Greek. The rest of our information about John comes from late 2nd century and afterwards. So there's very little New Testament information and not very much 1st century, late 1st century or early 2nd century information as well. Okay, so let's do a quick review of the events that were occurring during this time frame so that we have those events in our mind as we discuss the date of John's three epistles as well as the book of Revelation and his gospel. First of all, we want to look at and remember April 62, as Passover of 62, when Agrippa appointed Annas II to the high priesthood. Now, this is while Paul was in prison in Rome, back in Judea. Agrippa II, who was the king over the Jews at that point, appointed Annas II, that's the son of the Annas that arrested Jesus. His son Annas II now is in high priesthood here in 62 A.D., and Agrippa appointed him as the high priest in place of Joseph Kami, who was high priest just before that. Now, in 62, also in April there, right around Passover, Festus died. He was the Roman procurator or Roman governor, and he died about that same time. And then a few months later, probably about 3 months later, the new procurator, which was Albinus, arrived. And it took about 3 months for him to get appointed in Rome and then sent to Judea. And we're going to talk about what happened during that interim between the death of Festus and the arrival of Albinus 3 months later. Before Albinus arrived, Annas II illegally convened a Sanhedrin to condemn James and some of his companions. That's James, the Lord's brother, not James, the brother of John. James, the brother of John, had already died back in AD 44. So this is James, the Lord's brother, the brother of Jesus, was arrested by Annas II. And it says in Josephus that Annas arrested James and some of his companions, some of the other apostles, evidently. And I believe that's probably James, or John, that's referred to there, although Josephus doesn't say so. But the implication is that it's James and some of his fellow apostles there in Jerusalem were arrested. And John was there in Jerusalem at that time, so it's highly likely that John was one of those that was arrested at the same time James was. Then Annas killed James and evidently sent John into exile. We'll talk more about that exile and how that happened when we get to the traditions about John that are recorded for us in Eusebius and other early church father writings. Many of the Jews were upset by this killing of James because he was a very righteous guy, and all the Jewish people loved him. Even though they may not have been Christians, they still liked James because he was a very righteous, upstanding person who kept the law scrupulously, better than most of them did. And as a result, they complained and protested about this action of Annas to kill James. and they protested and complained to both Agrippa and Albinus. And I believe this may have been the reason why Annas was deposed from his high priesthood. In fact, Josephus flat out says that that was the reason why he was deposed by Agrippa, after only ruling as high priest for 3 months. As soon as Albinus got there, he and Agrippa had Annas II removed from his high priesthood. Well, I believe also June 62 is when John wrote the book of Revelation, of course, which predicts the Neronic persecution. It doesn't speak of the Neronic persecution as a past event. It instead predicts the Neronic persecution. Therefore, we know that it had to be written before the Neronic persecution occurred. That's a clear dating method. Not many people have mentioned that, but there's a few who have and noticed that prediction there in the book of Revelation. Okay, in July of 62, Albinus arrived and began to rule over Judea as procurator, and Albinus may have got together with Agrippa II and had Annas II deposed after only 3 months of high priesthood at that point in July of 62. Then Agrippa appointed Jesus, son of Damnaeus, to the high priesthood in place of Annas II. And it was not just a few months later after that, in October of 62, that Jesus the farmer started pronouncing his woe, woe upon Jerusalem, which he continued for 7 years until the first stones of the Roman siege began to pound on the walls of Jerusalem. And so this is a very interesting event that here in October 62, about the time John was on the island of Patmos writing the book of Revelation, we see this prophet who was a farmer who came to one of the feasts, the Feast of Booths, in the fall of the year, and began on a sudden crying out, "Woe, woe to Jerusalem." Well, it was in spring of 63, about a year after this, or 6 months after this, Paul wrote the Epistle of Hebrews. Paul was in prison at the time. These events were occurring there in Judea. And Paul was writing the book of Hebrews about that same time. And it's in the book of Hebrews that we find some of the similarities with the book of Revelation, suggesting that as he was writing the book of Hebrews, he must have got a copy of the book of Revelation. And so in the last two or three chapters of the book of Hebrews, Paul refers to some of the same content that we find in the book of Revelation, showing familiarity with it, suggesting that he hadn't got a copy by the time he was just about through with his Roman imprisonment. Then in late 63 or early 64, Peter wrote his first epistle, which also shows familiarity with the book of Revelation. As we noticed in times past, 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 13, where he mentions the fact that he was writing from a city named Babylon, which is code word for Jerusalem, as we know from the book of Revelation, showing that Peter had probably got a copy of the book of Revelation by that time and was familiar with how it was using the term Babylon in reference to Jerusalem, where he was writing at the time. And we know he was writing from Jerusalem because in the first chapter of 1 Peter, he mentions the fact that he's writing to those who are scattered outside of Palestine. That implies that he's writing from inside Palestine. So whatever Babylon is, it's a city inside Palestine. And if we take the book of Revelation as the key for that, then it tells us that Peter was writing from Jerusalem when he wrote that, and he was familiar with the book of Revelation, or else he had received an independent revelation of the same thing as that. but it's writing about the same time the book of Revelation was written, or afterwards. It's right afterwards, so that he would have had a chance to receive a copy of Revelation by that time that he wrote. Okay, the other event that I want to keep us aware of in our mind is late 64, in fact, July and later of 64, when the Neronic persecution broke out. As a result of the fire in Rome, the Jews went to Nero and got him to blame it on the Christians to get Nero off the hook. And so the Neronic persecution began in late 64, right after the fire in Rome in July of 64. Okay, those are the big dates that I want us to keep in mind. And I want to now try to fit the writings of John into those dates as much as we can, so that we see how they relate to and fit into those key dates that we've just reviewed. Well, here's the biblical facts that we know about Apostle John after Pentecost. In the book of Acts, we see a lot of mentions of John, especially in connection with Peter. In those early chapters, the first four chapters of Acts, we find John very, very much interacting with Peter a lot. In Acts chapter 8, when the gospel spread to the Samaritans, the Jerusalem church sent Peter and John down to Samaria. So for the first eight chapters of the book of Acts, we see Peter and John very closely associated and working together there in Jerusalem. They even went down to Samaria together. According to Galatians 2, verse 9, John was still there in Jerusalem, associated with Peter and James at the time of the Jerusalem Council in AD 49. So for the first 20 years of the church's existence, from basically AD 30 to AD 50, we see John there in Jerusalem working with Peter and James. So there were the three guys there. By the time of that Jerusalem council, however, James, the brother of John, had been killed by Herod Agrippa I in AD 44. The next thing we hear about John after the Jerusalem council is that he was exiled and sent to the island of Patmos off the coast of Turkey. This implies that John stayed in Jerusalem all the way from Pentecost to his exile. The idea of exile is that you're taken out of the land and sent outside the land to another remote point. And so the fact that he refers to himself as being exiled out of the land implies then that he was in the land continuously, all the way from Pentecost down to his exile in 62 A.D. Okay, and we also would note that John was one of the younger apostles of the 12. He's probably the youngest, according to many commentators on the life of John. They suggest that he was the youngest out of all the 12 apostles. And so he could have been as young as 15 or so at the time he became a disciple of Jesus, and could have been as young as 18 perhaps by the time of Pentecost. Certainly not much older than 20 by the time of Pentecost. And so if we take the older date, 20, and add 32 more years to it, he would have been around 50 or 52 by the time he was exiled to the island of Patmos in his early 50s. So that gives us a little bit of an idea of how old he might have been if he wrote the book of Revelation on Patmos before the Neronic persecution broke out in AD 62. He would have been about 52 years old at that point. Now, what else we need to look at in reference to John is the fact that in Matthew chapter 20 and its parallel account in Mark chapter 10, we see Jesus' prediction that James and John would both drink the same cup of martyrdom that Jesus drank, implying that both of them would die before the second coming, because the second coming is in the context there. They had asked Jesus to seat them on the right and left side of Jesus when he came into his kingdom at his parousia. And Jesus said, "That's not mine to give. And furthermore, are you worthy of it? Are you willing to drink the cup that I'm going to drink in order to earn that privilege of sitting on my right and left hand side?" And of course, they said, "Yes, we are willing to drink that cup." And Jesus said to them, "Then you will both." He uses the plural there. The "you" there is plural in the Greek in both Matthew and Mark's account. He said to both of them, James and John, "You both will drink my cup," the cup of martyrdom, the same cup of martyrdom that he was about to drink in the city of Jerusalem. That's very significant because it helps us understand why John must have died before the parousia, because the parousia is in that very context where they're talking about what would happen when Jesus came in power to establish his kingdom at his parousia. Then they wanted to be seated at his right and left hand at that point. And Jesus here is indicating, you're going to die before that event occurs. Because if they hadn't died before it, then they would not have experienced death at all. And this is where the basis for this tradition goes around among the church. There was a rumor that John would never die, because they thought Jesus had promised in John chapter 21 when he was talking to Peter. Peter had asked what's going to happen to John, and Jesus said, "What difference does it make to you whether he lives and remains or not? What difference does it make to you? It's none of your business. You just follow me and tend to your own business." And because of that statement to Peter, the rumor circulated that John would never die, that he would live and remain until the parousia, at which time he would be changed into his new immortal body and caught up to be with Christ without having to experience physical death. And that's where they got this idea of John never dying, is because they thought he would live and remain until Christ returned, so that he would be changed without experiencing physical death and caught up to be with Christ. Well, that rumor, of course, is disputed by John. He says in John chapter 21 that Jesus gave him no guarantee that he would live and remain until the parousia. Jesus only told Peter that it was none of Peter's business what was going to happen to John. If Jesus wanted him to remain until he come, that's fine. It's none of Peter's business. But Jesus didn't commit himself to that. He just said, if I wanted him to, it doesn't make any difference. You just pay attention to what you need to be doing, Peter. And so John shows that he's aware and probably remembered the prophecy of Jesus that he would drink the same cup that Jesus drank. And that awareness, by the time he wrote the book of John, the Gospel of John, in 60 or 61 A.D., that was several years after his brother James had already been killed and suffered the same fate as Jesus, had died a martyr's death. And so John, by that time, certainly knew what drinking that cup meant. There was no question in his mind that he was going to drink the same cup. And therefore, this statement of Jesus to him, to Peter, about minding his own business, I think really would have a lot of meaning, and that's why he disputed that rumor that was going around, because he knew he was probably going to die before the parousia came to bear. Okay, that's about all the biblical information we have in regard to Apostle John. That's anywhere near certain and easy to nail down and help us in our arrival of dates. But I think the evidence from Matthew chapter 20 and Mark chapter 10 is especially helpful, because it shows that John would die. He would drink the cup of martyrdom before Christ returned. Now, there's some traditions about John which go a lot further, of course, but they're not reliable, and we can't put too much stock in them unless they fit into the biblical narrative, acceptably and harmonize with it. And so we'll look at those real briefly here. There's some late traditions coming from the late 2nd century about what John supposedly did in Ephesus after he was released from Patmos. And they think that was in the mid-60s, or I'm sorry, in the mid-90s, about 30 years after what we're saying here. The late 2nd century writers like Irenaeus think that John was not released from Patmos until the 90s, and that he didn't write the book of Revelation until the 90s. But these traditions, I think, appear to be somewhat far-fetched, since that would mean that John was in his mid-80s, like 85 years old by the time he wrote the book of Revelation in 96 A.D., and approaching 90 years old by the time he was released to dwell in Ephesus. Those stories about him chasing down on foot one of his wayward disciples are hard enough to believe about a 50-year-old man in AD 63. It's far more difficult to believe that he did that in his 90s or in the mid-80s. So that's another reason why I reject some of these traditions about John that are recorded by the late 2nd century writers, because they just don't sound feasible for a person in his 80s and 90s to be doing those things. According to another story, when John entered the bathhouse on one occasion, he found Cerinthus, the Gnostic heretic, inside and immediately fled the scene. This is recorded for us by Irenaeus also. Here's what he says. He says, "There are also those who heard from him that John, the disciple of the Lord, going to bathe at Ephesus and perceiving Cerinthus within, rushed out of the bathhouse without bathing, exclaiming, 'Let us flee, lest even the bathhouse fall down, because Cerinthus, the enemy of truth, is within.'" Now, again, Cerinthus was after 70 A.D. If this story is true, of course, then it would mean that John lived after 70 A.D. And so Eusebius questions the validity of some of this, because he says there were two different Johns, one called John the Elder, who was distinguished from John the Apostle. Even in Irenaeus' statements, there's a distinction between those two, and especially in some of the other writers of the 2nd century. And so it could easily have been the other John that did this thing here that we're looking at, and not the Apostle John. There's another tradition about John that he was not harmed by being boiled alive in hot oil, and therefore, since they couldn't kill him by dipping him into burning oil, they decided to send him into exile. And this certainly could have happened in Judea before his exile, when he was arrested by Ananus II in 62 A.D. They may have tried to boil him alive in oil. And it may not have worked, and therefore they sent him in exile instead. So that could be a true tradition, and it could have happened in 62 AD there in Jerusalem. Certainly possible. But there's nothing in our Bible which would indicate that that happened, and certainly nothing in Josephus that would prove it either. So it's just another one of those traditions that could or could not be reliable. It doesn't make any difference to our historical narrative that we're building here. If you'd like to read a summary about all those different traditions in the 8-volume work by Philip Schaff called The History of the Christian Church, in volume 1 of that 8-volume set, he talks about all these traditions that surrounded the character of Apostle John. And if you are interested in knowing more about that, that's a good place to go look at him because he summarizes all of them pretty well. Okay, all of those later traditions about John may have a germ of truth in them, but their date of occurrence has been totally mishandled by the late second century writers. This becomes very evident when we look at the earlier traditions, which all the futurists ignore and sweep under the carpet, such as Papias. And we mentioned him before. And Papias is the earliest tradition we have about the Apostle John. And yet he's glossed over by the premillennial dispensationalist because it doesn't fit their theory about Apostle John writing the book of Revelation in AD 95. Papias says some things about Apostle John which force us to the conclusion that John must have died before the parousia. And we'll look at that here. Papias says that John was killed by the Jews, just like his brother James was. Furthermore, Papias backed up that claim by pointing straight at the biblical narrative in Matthew chapter 20 and Mark chapter 10, where it says that Jesus is talking to both James and John, and he says to both of them that you will drink the cup that I am about to drink, in Matthew chapter 20, verse 22 and 23. You might want to open your Bible and take a look at that. Matthew chapter 20, verse 22 and verse 23. Jesus said to them both that you both will drink the cup that I am about to drink. And then he says in verse 23, my cup you both shall drink. My cup. Well, what cup was the cup of Jesus? It was the cup of martyrdom. It was not just a generic cup of suffering and persecution. It was the specific kind of persecution that Jesus was about to suffer. He says here that I am about to drink. And, of course, we know what that was. It was the cross. It was death. And that's what Jesus says to both James and John, that they would also drink. My cup you shall drink. The cup that I am about to drink, he says in Matthew 20, verses 22 and 23. Then in Mark chapter 10, verse 38 and 39, the parallel passage, very similar. It says, you will both drink the cup that I drink. You'll be baptized with the baptism which I am baptized with. The cup that I drink, you both shall drink. And then he says, you both shall be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized. And so there again, we have double confirmation in both Matthew and Mark that both James and John would suffer martyrdom before the return of Christ with his kingdom, at which time he would seat the apostles on thrones beside him to judge the 12 tribes, as we find out in Matthew chapter 19, verse 28. Okay, notice what Papias says here about the death of John. He says in his second book, that John the theologian and James his brother were killed by the Jews. And Papias claims in the second book of the sayings of the Lord that John was killed by the Jews, thus clearly fulfilling, together with his brother, Christ's prophecy concerning them and their own confession and agreement about this. And he's referring here exactly to Matthew chapter 20 and Mark chapter 10. And so here Papias bases his belief on the tradition about James and John being killed by the Jews on the very statements of Matthew chapter 20 and Mark chapter 10. And Papias says, "For when the Lord said to them, 'Are you able to drink the cup that I drink?' And they eagerly assented and agreed. Then he said, 'You will drink my cup and will be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized.'" So Papias was very much aware of that prediction of Jesus that we find in Matthew chapter 20 and Mark chapter 10. Papias claimed that John was killed by the Jews, evidently at a time when they still had the ability and opportunity to do so. This would point to the Neronic persecution until it was cut short by the outbreak of the Jewish revolt. It would not have been easy for the Jews to do much against Christians after the war began in 66 AD, and especially not after the war had ended after 70 AD. They would have not had the power to kill any Christians after that point. And so, since Papias claims that John was killed by the Jews, and he's referencing Matthew chapter 20 and Mark chapter 10, which indicate that John would be killed before the parousia, that pretty much dates the death of John as sometime in the Neronic persecution. That's the most probable time when the Jews would have had unlimited power to kill anybody they wanted to. The Jews had no political or judicial power to kill anyone after 70 AD, but they did have that kind of power in the Neronic persecution. And so the Neronic persecution fits this description very well, since that's when the Jews would have been in their most powerful position to kill Christians. As we look at the biblical evidence in Matthew chapter 20, Mark 10, and John 21, we'll notice that it points unambiguously, I believe, toward the conclusion that Apostle John must have died in the Neronic persecution in 64 AD, about the same time Peter and Paul also were killed in that same persecution. And this is a couple of years before Christ returned in the clouds, as witnessed by many of the people in Judea, and referenced in the books of Josephus. The death of John before AD 70 would absolutely clinch the pre-70 date of all of his writings, including not only the Gospel of John and the book of Revelation, but his three short epistles as well. If he died before 70, then his books were written before he died. Duh. You know, it's amazing to me how our futurist buddies just don't get that. Okay, so it absolutely clinches the pre-70 date of all the Johannine writing and leaves the futurist no ground left to stand on. It completely negates all the other objections that futurists have against the preterist view using John's supposed longevity beyond AD 70. If he died before 70, then all of their arguments just vaporize. I need to note here that I have changed my position regarding the reason why I believe John was no longer around after AD 70. In my rapture book, I took the position that John was not around after 70 because he had been raptured. Those who were raptured did not experience physical death, but were simply changed into their new immortal bodies as they were being caught up to be with Christ in the unseen spiritual realm. Thus, if John was still alive at the time of Parousia, he would not have died and would not have experienced death of his physical body. It would have been changed into his immortal body without experiencing physical death. But that's no longer the position that I hold for John. I believe that John did not exist on earth after 70 AD because he had died in the Neronic persecution, not because he was raptured. So my settled position is that John was no longer around after 70 because he was killed in the Neronic persecution, and he suffered martyrdom before the Parousia and did not live and remain until the Parousia, and certainly not afterwards. Therefore, he was not raptured because he died before the Parousia occurred. It was the words of Papias and his reference to Matthew chapter 20 and Mark 10 which made me aware of this possibility that John died before the Parousia. And so after looking at that and restudying and exegeting Matthew chapter 20 and Mark 10, I'm far more convinced now that John died in the Neronic persecution and did not live and remain until the Parousia. Okay, I want to look at the date of John's gospel here. We're running close on time here, and I've got a lot of material. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to skip over about 6 pages of this notes about the dating of the apocalypse, because I've covered some of that already in our past sessions. And so I don't need to repeat it here. And it's going to be in the lesson outline PDF anyway, so you don't have to worry about missing out on it. It'll be there in the written PDF. So just get that PDF and you'll be all set. So I'm going to run rapidly through some of this material about the Gospel of John and its date, as well as the date of the book of Revelation, and hasten on down here to a discussion of the three short epistles, because in our past sessions I really have not dealt with those three epistles of John and put a date to them. And I've done a lot more study on that in the past week or so, and I want to share some of that with you. I think that'll be helpful. But let's look first of all at the Gospel of John. I believe it was the first of John's writings to be produced, the Gospel, and I would date it somewhere in the range of 60 or 61 and maybe very early 62, but I tend to put it at the earlier 60 date as much as possible, and I'll explain why. There's a lot of information about this in Eusebius. Eusebius suggests that the other three Gospels were written first before John wrote his, although he hedges a little bit on that, especially on Luke and John. And I want to look at some of the similarities. Some of the form critics and source critics have pointed out the fact that Luke borrows heavily from Matthew and Mark, but does not seem to borrow anything from the Gospel of John. And John doesn't borrow anything from Luke, as far as we know, except there's one short story that both Luke and John have, and we're going to talk about that. It's a story about Peter and John running to the empty tomb after Mary had come and reported that his body was not there in the tomb. Matthew and Mark do not record that story about Peter and John running to the tomb. Only Luke and John record that. And that's peculiar, and that helps us see when Luke and John may have been written by looking at how they record this story. And so Matthew and Mark are written first, evidently, and then Luke borrows heavily from Matthew and Mark, and John appears to share that one little story in common. However, John augments it and adds to it his own personal details, which Luke does not record. Luke only records the fact that Peter ran to the tomb. He does not record the fact that John ran to the tomb along with Peter. John's account is where that story is given. Now, explaining how that might have taken place in these two different accounts of that story is a real challenge, and that's why I've spent a lot more time on this than I would have normally, is because it's really hard to reason through this and see how this all happened originally and how it may have affected the date of these Gospels. So here's what I'm going to talk about there. I'm going to say this because we're running short on time. I don't want to read all of this, but I will read a section here. Both Luke and John seem to draw material from Matthew and Mark, but Luke does not borrow any of the exclusive material in John's gospel. However, there is one parallel between Luke and John which hints at John being influenced by Luke's version of the story. And that parallel is found in Luke chapter 24, verses 9 through 12, and John 20, verses 2 through 10. Looking at those two accounts of the story of Peter and John running to the tomb suggests that John's gospel was probably written after he had seen Matthew and Mark's less detailed accounts of that story, because they don't even mention the fact that Peter or John went to the tomb after Mary had warned them about the empty tomb and his body was not there. Matthew and Mark don't record that story at all. But Luke may have been in Jerusalem at the time Paul was in prison in Caesarea, doing his research in preparation for writing his own gospel. And he may have heard Peter recount that story about running to the tomb. And therefore, Luke then puts that in his notes and uses it when he writes his gospel later in Rome. Well, John was also aware of that story, and the fact that Matthew and Mark did not include it must have inspired John to record that part of the story in his gospel and express it from his own perspective, which had been left out by Matthew and Mark. So, while Luke was there in Jerusalem gathering his research for his gospel, he could easily have collaborated with both Peter and John and heard this story from Peter, which had not been recorded in Matthew and Mark. John probably heard Peter's side of the story and decided to tell the rest of the story in his own gospel account. John may have already noticed the briefer accounts in Matthew and Mark. Certainly he had. And had already planned, probably, to write a fuller account from his own perspective. And so this, well, I think, would explain how Luke and John could be writing basically at the same time, independently of each other, both knowing about that same story, Luke not including John's perspective in it, maybe because he knew John was going to write and tell it from his perspective, and so he let John do that. And so there's all kinds of possibilities. We don't have to believe that Luke's account was already written before John wrote his. That's the way Eusebius suggested, but I think there's a better explanation. And that's why I'm suggesting that maybe Luke was aware that John was going to write, and therefore did not include it in his version of the story. Luke does mention Peter running to the tomb, however, which is Peter's side of the story, and neither Matthew or Mark mentioned that much. So Luke was familiar with a story that John was about to tell in his gospel. This would date John as early as the fall of AD 60, just as Paul was leaving on his voyage to Rome, or as late as early 62 before John was exiled to Patmos. So I believe the Gospel of John was written before John was exiled on Patmos. So it's a pre-exilic or pre-Patmos gospel. And I think that makes a lot of sense. And there's a much more explanation about that in my notes here. You'll get the PDF and you'll see some of the other reasons why I date the Gospel of John before he went into exile. It just makes an awful lot more sense because it would have been written at a time when other Gospels were written and when that was the big thing and it needed to be circulated among all the churches at that point. It might make much more sense for it to have been written earlier, like in 60 A.D., than it would be for it to be written later on after he had already been exiled and after the persecution was heating up and they were running for cover and it was not safe to write anything significant at that point. So there's a lot of reasons why I dated earlier before he was sent into exile. Now let's talk about the book of Revelation just briefly. We've dealt with that in times past as well and show why we believe that the book of Revelation must have been written before the Neronic persecution, because the book of Revelation predicts the Neronic persecution, and therefore it would have to be written before the Neronic persecution took place, in which John and Peter and James all died. So obviously it would have to be written before John died in the Neronic persecution. And that would mean that he was exiled to Patmos before the Neronic persecution. And that's why I would connect his exile with the statements in Josephus where it says that Annas II arrested James and some of his companions. That was in the spring of AD 62. And that's when John was most likely arrested and sent into exile in the spring of 62 A.D. And I believe the book of Revelation was written shortly after that, as soon as he reached the island of Patmos, probably. He received that revelation because it's possible that he was released from Patmos and went over to Ephesus not long after he had been exiled. And the reason I say that is because Ananias was deposed from his high priesthood only after 3 months of being a high priest because of his killing of James and some of his companions. So whenever that high priest was deposed, that would have allowed Agrippa and Albinus to relieve John of his exile in Patmos. Now, it would not allow John to come back to Judea because you could not do that unless the death of the high priest occurred. And, of course, Annas II did not die until 68 A.D. during the war in Jerusalem. So Ananias had not died, so John could not come back to Judea. But he could be taken off the island of Patmos and allowed to live outside of Palestine somewhere. And, of course, that's by tradition what they say took place. He moved to Ephesus and remained there until he was killed in the Neronic persecution. So he could have been released shortly after he reached Patmos, right after he wrote the book of Revelation, then he could have been released and gone right back to Ephesus there, where he remained until the Neronic persecution about a year and a half later. It's possible that he was released there. And there's another possible release time as well. After Paul was released from prison, he mentions to Titus that Apollos and Zenas the lawyer were going to be coming through Crete on their way somewhere else. Now, what in the world would Apollos and Zenas the lawyer be doing in Rome? Well, obviously, they were probably helping Paul get released. They probably appeared before Nero at Paul's trial and defended him. And Apollos was a very good orator, and Zenas the lawyer would probably have all the legal precedents from the book of Acts to use to get Paul off the hook. Now that they had got Paul released, Paul says that they're on their way and going to travel through Crete on their way to somewhere else. Now, where in the world were they going? What would they be doing? They were evidently on a mission to go help somebody else. Could that have been Apostle John? Could they have been on their way to help Apostle John get released from his exile there on the island of Patmos? Well, it's possible. So there's two possible ways John could have been released. Either one of those was well before, at least a year before, the Neronic persecution broke out. And that would give John time to accomplish some of those things that later traditions say that happened to him while he was in Ephesus. And so there's a good historical basis for some of those traditions. They could very easily have occurred while John was in Ephesus after he had been released from Patmos. Okay, that's a real quick survey of the date for the book of Revelation. I believe it was written in 62 A.D., shortly after he arrived on Patmos, probably the summer of 62. Now we need to look at when the three short epistles of John were written here. Briefly, we want to try to summarize that here. Man, we've covered a lot of ground here, and a lot more is in the notes that you want to make sure you get the PDF to get the rest of this. Okay, the date for John's three epistles, 1 John, 2 John, and 3 John. Let's look at 1 John first. There's two possible dates here for these three epistles. Number one is that it could have been written from Jerusalem before he was exiled to Patmos in AD 61. That's one possible date. The other is that it was written from Ephesus after he was released from Patmos in AD 63. And so there's two possible dates, a pre-Patmos or a post-Patmos date, either 61 or 63. Well, the book of 1 John opens up much like his gospel, clearly directed against the Gnostics like Cerinthus and others later who were teaching docetism and dualism. You can see in the Epistle of 1 John, clear teaching against the Gnostics, especially in their docetism and dualism, and their concept of who Jesus was. They denied the deity of Christ, and you can see the deity of Christ very clearly presented in the Epistle of 1 John. There's a subtle hint in 1 John 2, verse 19, that can be interpreted either way for a pre-exile or post-exile date. John talks about some antichrist who had gone out from them, and that's evidently gone out from the church where John was at the time of writing. Now, question, is that Jerusalem or is that Ephesus? And how do you know? This certainly could apply to the church in Jerusalem, but it could also apply to the church in Ephesus We know that the Gnostics were in Ephesus and all the whole area there of the Lycus Valley around Asia Minor. That's where the Gnostics were pretty strong. And so it would not be surprising to see this kind of harsh condemnation of the Gnostics coming from Ephesus after John was released from the island of Patmos. But it certainly could have come from John before he went to Patmos while he was still in Jerusalem. But it fits a residence of John right there in Ephesus, I think, the best, because it betrays a first-hand knowledge of what was going on in Ephesus and the other nearby cities of the Lycus Valley. John could have heard about that situation in Ephesus while he was still in Jerusalem and could have written to those churches from his residence in Jerusalem, but it makes a lot more sense and seems much more suitable to a post-Patmos setting there in Ephesus. The whole anti-Gnostic tone of the letter implies that the letter was sent to a whole group of churches, possibly including Greece, Macedonia, Turkey, Cyprus, and Syria, where that Gnostic tendency was the strongest. John would not be writing these things only to the churches in Asia Minor if he was living right there in the area. He would have simply visited those nearby churches or had their leaders come to visit him there in Ephesus. So if John wrote this letter from Ephesus after he was released from his imprisonment on Patmos, it would have been written as a general encyclical for all the churches in that whole region, including Greece, Macedonia, Turkey, Cyprus, and Syria. And the same can be said about the letter if it was written from Jerusalem before his exile. It would probably be a general encyclical as well and be sent to all those same churches throughout that whole region. So it was most likely a general encyclical that would have been circulated among all the churches that were affected by the Hellenistic Gnosticism that was rampant throughout all those areas. In 1 John 4, verse 3, talks about the spirit of the Antichrist and says that the spirit of the Antichrist, which they had heard was coming, was now active in the world. Now, interesting. Note John's reference here to the fact that they had already been warned about the coming of these Antichrist. Where is that warning? And if we know where that warning is in some of the other books of the New Testament, then we'll know that 1 John was written after that book where that warning occurs. You see the logic there? So they were warned in a previous book, evidently, or maybe by word of mouth, that the spirit of Antichrist was coming, and John is saying now he is there. He's already in the world. He's now active. Note John's reference to the fact that they had already been warned. This raises the question about when and where and how they had been warned about the spirit of the Antichrist. Was this warning in a previous letter to them, or is John referring to the book of Revelation as being that warning? These antichrists had gone out from the church, wherever John was, and were now out in the world deceiving and working against the true teachings about Christ, denying his messiahship, deity, incarnation, and the need to be sanctified and godly. Now, I think you can see where I'm headed here. If 1 John was written after he was released from Patmos, then the book of Revelation would be that very warning about the Antichrist coming. And so John then would be referring to the book of Revelation, which they had already read and heard about and known. John says here that the activity of the evil one is intense. He says the world is passing away. It is the last, not day or month or year. It is the last hour. Christ was about to appear. Again, this echoes the intense language we find in the book of Revelation, suggesting that 1 John could have been written after John's release from Patmos in early 63, after he had already written the book of Revelation and put it in circulation. But it might also fit the situation while Paul was back in Jerusalem before he was sent into exile. But I just don't think that's the case. I'll leave the possibility open, but it certainly seems to me that it was written after he was released from Patmos. If it was written before his exile, it would certainly give us some great commentary on what John says to the seven churches in the book of Revelation. Comparing these two descriptions of the condition of the churches in Asia Minor at the time of writing both the Apocalypse and this first epistle would probably give us some further clues as to the time of the writing. However, I would tend to think that it's probably going to give us clues that it was written after his release from the exile on Patmos. It's really hard to tell for sure which of the two scenarios is correct, so I'll simply give the two possible dates and leave the question open to further study. Now, in reference to 2 John, there again is two possible dates for it as well, and same way for 3 John. All three of these epistles could have been written before or after his exile, and it's up to us to look at the internal evidence and make up our mind, and that's what I've done here. And as we get down into 3 John, I think you're going to see why I'm leaning more in the later date of 63, because the third epistle really begins to give us some good, clear information about when they may have been written, and we'll look at that. But let's look at 2 John first. This book is also difficult to date, just like the first epistle, and virtually for the same reasons. However, there are a couple of statements in the epistle which tend to make more sense if it was written from Ephesus after his release from Patmos. Notice 2 John verse 4, where he says that he was very glad to find some of them walking in truth. Now, notice that word find there. He was very glad to find some of them walking in truth. This implies that John had visited them recently, or that someone in association with John had visited them and reported back to John about their condition, and that as a result of this, he had found some of them walking in the truth. Very interesting statement. And this is very interesting because it's evidently written to those churches in the Lycus Valley there, the seven churches of Asia, same churches that the book of Revelation was written to. And those were churches that many of whom had been established by Apostle Paul, but Apostle Paul was in prison at the time John was in exile. And so it would not be surprising to see John use this language after he's released from exile to use this language about finding some of them still faithful to Christ, some of them still walking in the truth, because Paul had not been there and John had not been there. It was refreshing to John to find some of them still walking in the truth because they didn't have any apostles around helping them stay faithful. So this previous personal visit or some of his associates visiting there and reporting back to him, this idea of a visit is further augmented by his statement in 2 John verse 12 that he hoped to come to them and speak face to face. Evidently sometime soon. This would fit a scenario in Ephesus much better than a scenario in Jerusalem. It'd be kind of hard to get there very soon from Jerusalem, but it would be fairly easy for him to visit them shortly if he was in Ephesus. This letter seems to be a general encyclical written to the whole church, the elect lady, he says. which is the bride of Christ, the church, and all of her children, 2 John verse 1. Still, there is no proof here that it was written after his release. All this language could still be applied to a writing from Jerusalem before his exile. Since this epistle is somewhat obscure in its references to its intended recipients, it suggests that it was written at a time when the persecution was beginning to heat up, when such encoded messages like this would have been necessary to protect both the writer and the recipients. And so that's, again, another reason why I would tend to date it in 63, because it's closer to the Neronic persecution, and it's also at a time when the persecution was really beginning to heat up, much more so than it was in 61 A.D. when he was still in Jerusalem. Okay, now let's look at 3 John. And as we noted, there's two possible dates for it as well. However, I believe when we look closely at about three or four of these different passages in 3 John, I think we'll see that it is most likely written after John was released from Patmos and is in Ephesus. It's possible to date this epistle before John's exile, but it's just as plausible to date it after his release. There are several complicating factors here which should give us some clarity, but they still make it more difficult to nail it down precisely and absolutely. In 3 John, verse 1, John addresses this epistle to Gaius, somebody by the name of Gaius, or Gaius. Is this the same Gaius who lived in Corinth, as we've learned from Romans chapter 16, verse 23, where Paul was at the time he wrote the epistle of Romans? He was in Corinth, staying at Gaius's house. So that could be the Gaius that John is writing to here, or it could be the co-worker of Paul that came from Derbe in Macedonia, according to Acts 19, verse 29, and Acts 20, verse 4. Or it could be a totally different Gaius or Gaius altogether. It could be a third Gaius, which is not one of the other two that we just mentioned. We don't know for sure who this Gaius is. However, he was evidently loosely connected with a church whose leader, Diotrephes, had refused to support the traveling evangelist that John had sent through that area. Now, Gaius is evidently associated with that church where Diotrephes is, and John is writing to Gaius not to go along with what Diotrephes is doing. Diotrephes had refused to support those traveling evangelists that John had sent through that area on their way to do missionary work, evidently. John urges Gaius to support those traveling evangelists who were evidently bringing this letter to him, 3 John verses 5 through 8, and not to follow the bad example of Diotrephes, who had refused to support those traveling missionaries and even excommunicated any of the church members who tried to support them. 3 John verses 9 through 11. Then in 3 John verse 12, John recommends Demetrius to Gaius, suggesting perhaps that Demetrius may have been one of the messengers carrying this letter. Evidently, Demetrius was previously known to the church there where Gaius was. But for some reason, Demetrius needed John's recommendation and endorsement to make him acceptable to Gaius and the church there so that they would support Demetrius and the other traveling missionaries. Evidently, John felt that since they already knew Demetrius, that John's endorsement would carry further weight in getting them to support such traveling missionaries like Demetrius. John says here in verses 13 and 14 of 3 John that he had a lot more to write to them, but that he would save that for a personal visit shortly. Now, we're going to read between the lines here a little bit and do a little historical reconstruction. It seems as though this letter was a warning from John to Gaius, and perhaps Diotrephes also, that they needed to change their ways because John was coming there personally and shortly to set matters straight if they had not already been corrected by the time he got there. All three of the names mentioned in this epistle, Gaius, Diotrephes, and Demetrius, are Greek names suggesting that this church was in Greece, Macedonia, or Turkey. And the fact that John was close enough to them that he could come visit them shortly also points to the probability that John was in Ephesus at the time of writing. This does not fit a Jerusalem place of origin as well as it does Ephesus. And the state of the church under Diotrephes, which obviously had a dictatorial type of leader instead of being led by a group of elders, more easily fits a time after his exile when the churches of Asia had so many problems, as was described also in the book of Revelation. So it seems to be written at a time probably after the book of Revelation was written. It does not seem as likely that John would have been addressing these problems in the Greek churches before his exile to Patmos, especially telling them that he was going to visit them shortly and straighten them out. This condition of the church and his warning that he was intending to visit them soon fits a post-Patmos scenario in Ephesus much better. And now you can see why I've saved 3 John till the last, because I think it points the most clearly to a post-Patmos date. And evidently, it was written at a time when it was still safe for evangelists to do mission trips, which obviously would be before the Neronic persecution broke out, after which it would not be safe for anybody to do mission work. It would only get you killed. So this, I think, pretty well nails 3 John down to a post-Patmos date. Using this argumentation from 3 John and working backwards into 2 John and 1 John, it appears more likely now that 2 John and maybe even 1 John, and I believe for all those three epistles, were written by John in Ephesus after he had been released from his exile on Patmos. To be safe, however, until further analysis can verify this, it would be wise for us to leave open the possibility that 1 John at least might have been written from Jerusalem before John was sent into exile. However, if I had to decide right now, at this stage in my studies, I would probably date all three epistles after John was released from Patmos in AD 63 and before he was killed in the Neronic persecution in AD 64. Well, that'll wrap it up for this session. I hope that's been interesting for you. Next time, we'll try to get into some other areas dealing with the events that happened after Paul was released from his prison. Talk about what he did in his activities after he was released from Rome. That'll wrap it up, and we'll talk to you next time. Thanks for listening.